From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This weekend marks the beginning of Ramadan, and Muslims around the world will begin a month-long fast, and they'll also engage in acts of charity. Charity is a religious obligation among people devoted to Islam, and it is of particular importance this time of year. But what happens when our government's anti-terrorism laws prevent American Muslims from donating to charities of their choice? Later in the program, a Muslim lawyer will talk about this very situation and his solution to it. Plus, we'll learn how shunning technology has actually helped one newspaper. The publisher of the country's oldest Amish weekly joins me shortly. But first, I need to pause for a moment and ask, what in the world is going on in America? With all this shouting, screaming, and flashing of guns at events intended to advance democracy through civil dialogue, is this a political strategy carefully orchestrated by powerful self-interest groups that will lose a lot of money and influence if Congress passes meaningful health care legislation? Or have we just gone crazy? I can't get out of my head the sad, disturbing picture of an out-of-control man screaming into the face of Senator Arlen Specter, calling him a liar, condemning him to hell, and ranting that we're abandoning the Constitution in our deliberations aimed at providing health care for all Americans. You know what? I've actually been relieved to learn that much of the meanness that we're seeing in the town hall meetings is not so much spontaneous expressions of out-of-control American citizens as it is the performance of a script written and directed by organizations more focused on protecting the profits of health insurance companies than advancing the public's welfare. And I know that many of you are concerned about this situation as well. I know that because you've told us that. I've heard from many listeners expressing their own frustration and asking me to share my thoughts. For example, I heard from Mike and Marcia from Wisconsin. They wrote me saying, "We'd like to know what you think about the healthcare debate, where you come down as a Christian leader." Eleanor from Georgia wrote, "I'm listening to the Ed show on MSNBC and am so disillusioned. Two men of the cloth are talking with Ed." Eleanor was referring to an interview that Ed Schultz was doing with Bishop Harry Jackson and Reverend Derek Harkins. Eleanor points out that one of these guests is saying that it's more important for those who can afford health care to get it than to have all people get health care. That if we have a public option, then the hospitals and clinics will be too full for the rich to get care. "What is this?" asks Eleanor. "Is this a new Christianity? Are there two Christianities? The one that follows Christ and tries to act like him and another that follows the almighty dollar?" Eleanor, too, asked that we address this issue on State of Belief. And so, Let me tell you, the very first time that I testified before Congress was back in the early 1970s. I was then a staff member in the Social Ethics Agency of the Southern Baptist Convention. My, how things have changed. My testimony was in support of legislation to provide national health care for all Americans. That was the 1970s, remember. Over the intervening 40 years, I have not wavered in my conviction that our nation needs to assure health care for all of its citizens. I'm gratified that so many millions of other people are now articulating the same plea. But I want to make two points. First off, both Jim Wallace of the religious organization Sojourners and MSNBC host Ed Schultz have framed the call for national health care around Jesus. What would Jesus do? Ed Schultz asked that question on his show, the show that our listener wrote to us about. And Jim Wallace continues to say that health care is a theological and moral issue. Now, as a Christian myself, those statements resonate with me. But the appropriate foundation for legislation on national health care is not anyone's religion. Rather, it is the need for the nation to do right by all of its citizens and keep faith with the Constitution. Yes, for Christians, theology is relevant to health care. But not all religions are theistic, and not all Americans are religious or theistic. And all Americans need to come to the table on this issue. Health care is a moral issue, but not moral in that it is an exclusively Christian, Jewish, or Muslim virtue. It's a value essential in life together. That's why every other industrialized nation in the world has a program of national health care. Providing health care for everybody is about the decency, integrity, compassion, the moral fabric of our nation. Now, frankly, it's become difficult to find the ethical, moral high ground in the current debate. I find it difficult to understand the misinformation, deception, false characterizations, and lies about national health care being perpetrated by business professionals and even religious leaders. What's going on with the religious conservatives over at the Family Research Council? They're spending huge sums to perpetuate misinformation about national health care, providing federal funds for abortions, which is not true, and resulting in a massive increase of euthanasia among elderly Americans, which also is not true. Why, Tony Perkins? Why? The moral principle of national health care must find a policy expression through which the how of health care is consistent with the why of health care. Our Constitution mandates government providing for the public's welfare. Compliance with that primary function of government necessitates health care for everybody that is not taken away or denied or counseled because people have been sick. Yes, we have to be fiscally responsible. But why should we be so outraged by the cost of health care and so mutedly compliant regarding shockingly spiking numbers related to war, security, and other public welfare concerns? So, Mike, Marcia, and Eleanor, I am in total support for national health care. Whether people join this effort motivated by religion or by the basic compassion among American citizens, I don't care. But we have to get it right for the good of hurting people and for the good of our nation. And if that takes courage, as does most meaningful change, then leaders must demonstrate that all-too-rare commodity. We're waiting. Several months ago, I was with Senator Ted Kennedy at an event. In a casual conversation, I reminded him of work that we did together on national health care in the early 70s. Senator Kennedy remembered, smiled, and then commented about the amount of money that would have been saved and the number of lives that would not have been lost had we acted on this issue just short of a half century ago. Friends, we must not wait any longer. Whether compelled by conscience or patriotism or both, it is time for healing in our land in the fullest sense of the term, healing. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. And still to come on today's show, a look at the predicament many Muslim Americans find themselves in each Ramadan. Their faith requires them to give to charity. Their government has made it increasingly difficult to do so, at least if they're giving to Muslim charities, many of which have been targeted under anti-terrorism laws. We're going to talk about that right after this short break. You won't want to miss it. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, and this weekend marks the beginning of Ramadan, when Muslims around the world begin a month-long fast. It's also a time when Muslims will practice another tenet of their faith, zakat, or charity. But in the years since September 11th, Muslim Americans have found it increasingly difficult to fulfill this religious obligation. Muslim charities here in the U.S. have faced the excessive scrutiny from the United States government, and several religiously affiliated nonprofits have been shut down or have had their assets frozen under anti-terrorism laws. Now, where does that leave individuals? Those who want to give, want to fulfill their religious obligation, but fear that they could see their contribution confiscated by the government, or worse yet, could find themselves under federal investigation. Well, a new program spearheaded by the organization Muslim Advocates offers guidance to charities and to individual donors. I'm joined right now by Akhil Vohra. Akhil is a staff attorney with Muslim Advocates and head of the Muslim Charity Works campaign. Akhil, thank you for joining us here on State of Belief.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
I want to talk about your program in just a second, but first of all, please give us some context. How difficult has it become for Muslim Americans, both individual charities and individual donors?
The federal government has definitely made it more difficult and confusing for donors to give to American Muslim charities that do work here and abroad. What's interesting, though, is that this isn't an issue that's affecting just the American Muslim community, but foundations and charitable groups across the United States. Essentially, post 9/11, there was a combination of laws, executive orders, and regulations that really made it that created more hurdles for organizations to give abroad. Essentially, there's been kind of an alphabet soup of lists created that require individuals to check lists before they give money abroad. What we're hoping is that through the Muslim Charities Accreditation Program, we're providing proper guidance for organizations to kind of clear these hurdles and make it easier for them to give the obligatory zakat.
If I understand the situation correctly, if an individual unknowingly gives to a charity that comes under investigation, that individual could face serious consequences, even after having given with the best of intentions. What is the risk, as you see it, the risk for individual donors?
I think you're absolutely right. Basically, the government has set up a strict liability standard that intent does not matter. And the ramifications are dire. Again, zakat or tithing is a religious obligation for Muslims. And if this is being frustrated, we see this as a serious issue. Mm-hmm. So, again, beginning this program last year, right before Ramadan began, to provide proper guidance to nonprofits through our educational seminars, mm-hmm. working with the Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance, I think assures donors they can take the proper steps and the right steps to secure confidence in philanthropy again.
I know that your new program offers some very specific guidance for charities so they can avoid being targeted by the government. And what kind of advice is that? Give us an example or two of what you recommend.
Sure. We think it's a very comprehensive program. It covers legal, financial, and governance issues. And transparency is a huge part of that. Again, partnering with the Better Business Bureau, the Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance has 20 standards of charity accountability. These standards cover conflict of interest policies, how much money should be spent on programs, a lot of day-to-day policies and procedures that we think create transparency and help strengthen donor confidence. Mm-hmm. Also, with our educational seminars, we provide guidance on employment law issues and giving philanthropy abroad that is definitely beneficial to these groups.
Before we end the conversation, I want you to take a minute to talk generally about zakat or charity or the discipline of tithing. The current situation that we're talking about is really hindering what is a basic tenet of your faith. So if you will, talk just a little bit about the importance of zakat.
Well, Welton, thanks for the opportunity. Again, zakat is one of the main five pillars of Islam, and it's obligatory on Muslims if they have a certain amount of money to tithe 2.5% on net earned income. And for Muslims, this is a very important responsibility and duty that is typically exercised during the month of Ramadan. So, we launched the Muslim Charities Accreditation Program last year, right before Ramadan. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary, and we definitely are making a push to let people know that they should be exercising their duty and responsibility for charity.
Akhil Vohra is a staff attorney with Muslim Advocates and head of the Muslim Charity Works campaign. I really do appreciate you being with us on State of Belief. And if I may say so personally, I hope you have a very meaningful Ramadan.
Well, then thanks for the opportunity and thank you for the well wishes.
I'm Welton Gaddy. And up next on the show, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denies that he recently called Obama officials Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod self-hating Jews. But whether or not he uttered those words, it's not the first time a Jewish American official has found his faith criticized because of politics. And the criticism is coming from other Jews. We've got more on that to come. Stick around. We'll be right back. Again, everybody, and thanks for staying tuned to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Recently, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made headlines for supposedly calling Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel and Senior Advisor David Axelrod self-hating Jews. The comments reportedly came in response to their support of Obama's pressure on Israel to suspend settlement activity in the West Bank. The comments have since been denied, but this isn't the first time Jewish American officials have been the victims of such attacks, attacks which target one's faith when really the issue at hand is one of policy. I'm joined right now by journalist Ron Campius, the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Ron, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's still unclear, I suppose, whether or not Netanyahu actually said this about Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod, but I do understand there's a history of these kinds of critiques being lobbed at Jewish American officials. Let's start, if you will, give us some context for all of this.
Sure. It goes back to at least Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's and then President Ford's Secretary of State. Under Ford, he actually went further than any other Secretary of State, I think, Jewish or non-Jewish, in terms of confronting Israel over an issue. And then it was then over the issue of Israel's readiness to go to peace talks with the Egyptians. And he talked about reassessing the relationship with Israel, which was to go quite far. And the pro-Israel lobby here rallied, and they managed to get the Ford administration to back down. But Kissinger was vilified in Israel as something of a traitor to the Jews for having gone that far, and it continued. It was a feature of the Clinton administration, which had a lot of Jewish Americans in senior positions. Martin Indyk was the ambassador to Tel Aviv, and then he was the top Middle East negotiator, and then I think he went back to being ambassador to Tel Aviv. And at one point, a right-wing cabinet minister, Rehavam Zevi, used a word for him in Hebrew. It's Yehudon. It means little Jew. It's like a word that's used to describe the sort of cowardly diaspora Jews. Mm. And they actually had to physically be separated. So, yeah, it goes back.
Well, it seems to me that the theme here is an interesting one. Instead of attacking head-on the non-Jewish president from a policy point of view, it's almost more effective politically to question a Jewish administration official's loyalty to their faith. Is that close to getting at it?
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of the tactics now. I mean, incidentally, it's true that Netanyahu's office is adamantly denied that they use those terms, but there have been tensions. But I think it's just also, it's personal. It's sort of looking at somebody that you thought would be on your side, and then they get into government, and they're not necessarily on your side because they're representing a different interest. Mm-hmm. I think it happens to anybody who comes to government from any kind of, that's identified with any kind of interest, and then they have to, you know, they have to deal with the exigencies of government. It happened during the Bush administration as well, and Bush was considered closer to Israel than any other president, and it didn't make headlines like it it is now, but there were tension.
What is their typical response, or do they even respond to these kind of attacks?
It's usually subterranean. There's not a it's not something that they'll make public. If they feel under attack, they'll make their displeasure known to the Jewish organizations privately, or they'll deal with it privately. But one response would be to raise the issue and to say, you know, you're going over the line here. And more recently, there's a sort of there's now the beginnings, it's still very much in its nascent stages of a left-wing pro-Israel lobby with groups like J Street. And so now, and Steve Cohen, for instance, is the one person I mentioned. Bob Filner from San Diego is another one. Now they're sort of seeking shelter with that. They're saying, look, we have an alternative. We don't necessarily have to hew the corporate line on Israel. We can nuance a little bit.
So if it's subterranean, as you say, it really is not causing necessarily a deep division among Jewish supporters of these people.
Oh, no. I think that's, on the other hand, Israel and the pro-Israel community is also very careful. These are the people that they can't confront because they have a lot of credibility. I mean, a good example is Gary Ackerman. I think he's from New York. He's a congressman. He's the chairman of the Middle East Subcommittee. And he's gone farther than any other congress member, I think, in recent years in terms of criticizing both the Israelis and the Palestinians, although probably a little more harshly the Palestinians, but still he's tough with the Israelis on their failures to take the necessary steps towards peace. And he has a perpetual Republican opponent who's also Jewish in his district who constantly attacks them for this, and she doesn't make any headway because he's a trusted representative, and he has a very strong pro-Israel record throughout his career, so he can afford to do those things.
There is an irony here. Jewish American politicians are often called by us here at home because of their support for Israel, and at the same time, they're presumed to be anti-Jewish by Jews abroad. Do you think, is that a fair assessment of what's going on?
I think when you say they're presumed to be anti-Jewish by Jews abroad, I think that's it's sort of by maybe by right-wing Jews in Israel. Mm-hmm. I think overall Israelis appreciate them and appreciate the work they do. There's just this reflex consideration among some people who are concerned about Jewish survival, concerned about the history of the Jews and the vulnerability of the Jews, that say that, you know, that it's all or nothing. And I think that sometimes officials like Rahm Emanuel get the brunt of that. One of the most pronounced episodes was a guy named Dov Zakheim, who's like, you know, he's a religious guy, very active in Jewish and pro-Israel organizations here in Washington. I think he's on the executive of the American Jewish Committee. And he's been fairly senior in the Pentagon a couple of times under both George Bushes. And the first time, he cut off funds for the Levi project, which was this combat aircraft project that Israel was developing. And he was outright called a traitor by Israel's defense minister at the time. You know, you either had to be backing this or you didn't. And Zakheim said, you know, his position was he was working for the Pentagon, working for the American government, and it was a waste of money. And so, therefore, he cut it off. It was very straightforward.
I guess I'm asking you to step outside your role just a little bit, because you are the unbiased observer, reporter of what's going on. But what is your counsel, or what would be your counsel if one of these politicians came to you and said, look, I'm getting hit from both sides, and there's a lot of misunderstanding here. What do you think I ought to do? What would your counsel be?
I would say that I would counsel that politician to, you know, to stay the course, be true to whatever his or her beliefs are, but to make very clear that he's acting out of concerns both for American policy and for Israel policy, and to make it clear to the constituents. I mean, this isn't the case with a Jewish congresswoman, but Donna Evans here in suburban Maryland. She's taken a very sort of liberal take on Israel. She's criticized it, which is fine. I mean, it's her right. Big mistake she made until very recently was that she didn't take her case to the Jewish community where she lives, and there's a substantial Jewish community where she lives. And that just exacerbated things. It's always good to keep lines of communication open and to talk to your constituents and explain why you're coming from, where you're coming from. And that tends to, I think, tamp down a lot of tensions.
My guest is Ron Campius, the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. I tell you, this is fascinating stuff, and the principles involved have an application way beyond just this specific topic. Ron, thanks so much for speaking with me here on State of Belief.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm Welton Gaddy. We've got to take a short break right now, but please don't go anywhere, because there's a lot more to come. And when we come back, I want to talk with the publisher of a newspaper dubbed the Amish Internet. And ironically, this paper doesn't even have an online edition. I think you're going to like this interview. Stay tuned. Welcome back to State of Belief, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. It's no secret that newspapers around the country are facing financial distress, brought on by a loss of advertising revenue, a drop in subscriptions, and competition from other online sources of news. But for one tiny paper in Ohio, subscription rates and ad sales have remained steady. In fact, this publication doesn't even have an online edition. You see, the paper called The Budget is the country's largest Amish newspaper. Delivered each week by mail to its 20,000 subscribers in the United States and Canada. And as a recent profile in the Associated Press pointed out, by avoiding technological advances, the budget may actually have discovered the model for maintaining a successful newspaper. I'm joined right now by the publisher of the paper, Keith Rathbun. Keith, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, thanks for having us on, Welton.
Now, I was just thinking, before we get to the questions, that if ignoring technology would be a key to success, my staff would say I should be very successful because I am no good with it at all.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I've heard that from several people. So,
I bet. Yeah.
But technology's supposed to be our friend.
That's right. Well, I have to begin by pointing out that you're not Amish, but you are not only publisher of the oldest Amish newspaper, you actually own 10% share of the paper. Did you ever imagine yourself in this position?
I didn't growing up, but I did have a lot of relationships with Amish people and with the Amish communities, even from up in Cleveland. I had a principal in elementary school who his first teaching job was in the Amish communities, and he introduced me to the Amish. We used to do exchanges in fifth and sixth grade, so I've always had a fondness for the communities. When the opportunity came to come here and publish the newspaper, I considered it quite a privilege and an honor, and thought I'd find out real quick if I knew what I was doing or not with the Amish from having a traditional paper. But it's been great.
As I understand it, despite the fact that most papers are struggling, as I said in the introduction, the budget has been relatively unaffected. What's the secret to that?
Part of it is the online. It's the technology that the people, we have not cannibalized ourselves by going online. But a lot of it is just the trust that the people have in the newspaper, the way we carry the letters. We have 843 writers across the United States. We call them scribes. And many of the Amish communities have a scribe in its community. Mm-hmm. There's over 1,000 communities, and we don't have scribes from all of them yet. We haven't been able to grow big enough to include them all, but we add probably 20 to 40 a year. Mm-hmm. They write the news from their area, and our readers just, it's so important to them. I compare it to the old Christmas newsletters that sort of went out when people would send a Christmas card, and it was like, here's what's happened in the last year, except they're writing about what's happened in the last week.
Right. I read that you call the budget the Amish Internet, and yet when you actually thought about putting the paper online, your contributors threatened to go on strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, we mentioned very casually back in 2006 that there was a possibility that we wanted to look at putting the paper online. And as soon as that went out, the writers, the Amish writers that we have, our scribes, just wrote to us and said, we have no interest in our letters being online.
Hmm.
And we needed to respect that.
I'm curious, you came to the budget from an alternative weekly in Cleveland, so what has this experience done to your thinking about the business of newspapers or maybe even journalism in general?
You know, I found that the paper that we had up in Cleveland was mostly a music alternative paper. And community newspapering is community newspapering. You need to know the community that you're writing for and that you're serving. So I gained a lot of respect just for journalism and for the profession by coming down, realizing that, you know, it's almost like baseball and how close, with all the technological advances through the years, better bats, bigger gloves and that play at first base is still just bang, bang. And to me, it's like, you know, that journalism, true good journalism, just hasn't changed.
I have to ask you as well, what has covering the Amish done to you personally?
It has probably increased my spirituality. I think that the one thing that comes to my mind, Welton, is the nickel mines tragedy that happened a few years ago in Pennsylvania when a milk delivery guy went in and he killed 5 children.
Yes.
And that night, the parents of those five children had gone to, you know, the gunman had been killed, and they went to visit that gunman's wife and took food to her, and she had children too, and they took food to her and said, look, you know, we know you're grieving as well. And the ability to forgive is just so unbelievable with the Amish that, and I respect that so much that I think that I've been humbled by that. And I have found the ability to, you know, being English and growing up, I always thought, boy, if something ever happened to one of my kids, look out. And I respect their ability to forgive and just put things in God's hands.
Keith Rathman is the publisher of The Budget, the country's oldest and largest Amish newspaper. Mm-hmm. Keith, thanks for your time, and thanks for enlightening State of Belief listeners.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for taking the interest in talking to us, and hope to hear from you again.
Well, friends, that's our show for this week. But before we go, I want to share with you some of the great responses that we received to a recent program. 2 weeks ago, we aired my conversation with two leaders in the Episcopal Church, the first openly gay bishop, Bishop Jean Robinson, and the second female bishop to be ordained, Bishop Jane Dixon. I was so inspired by this conversation, and so were many of the listeners. Here's what some of you had to say. A woman named Ruth wrote to say, I was so humbled to hear Bishop Jean Robinson say that he regulates his own reactions to critics by reminding himself that he will be in heaven with these individuals someday. Now, this is a lesson for all of us in learning to love the difficult people in our lives. And we also heard from a listener named Nancy. Nancy says, I am a member of the Episcopal Church, and I got tears in my eyes listening to Jean Robinson and Jane Dixon. I am so proud to be an Episcopalian, such a welcoming and loving group. Thank you for having Jean and Jane as your guests. And thanks to both of you for your comments. And for those of you who missed my interview with Bishops Robinson and Dixon, you can go to our show archives, stateofbelief.com, and hear it for yourself. And while you're there, you too can write to me. We'd love to hear from you. Just click the Contact Us page and share your thoughts. You also, remember, can call us and record your thoughts. Our telephone number is 202-238-3291. Let me say it again, 202-238-3291. Please call us. As always, I must remind you that State of Belief is brought to you each week by the Interfaith Alliance. Care about protecting religious diversity in this country? Well, that's what we're all about. Become a member of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to Interfaith Alliance to learn more. And make sure that you tune in next week for all new conversations about religion, politics, culture, what's happening in this nation. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.